Hello and welcome to the next episode of the podcast on negotiation. And today we have a very special guest, Robin Kensel. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you for inviting me in, Remy. I'm really looking forward to our conversation today.
Guys, Robin is an amazing person. Guess what? I mean, she is like the modern Renaissance woman. Yes? Not only is she a successful business person, she is engaged in the local community. She's a ballroom dancer. She's a spiritual leader. She is a coach. I mean, I'm sort of running out of my fingers to mention everything that you're doing, Robin. And I probably forgot to mention half of the things that are highly relevant in the context of our conversation. Where do you find time for all this?
You know, my parents owned a nursing home. So growing up, the nursing home was always open. I learned to never waste time and to always be busy with something. I mean, my mother had us going from thing to thing to thing. So I think I find time because I use my time very prudently. I'm very clear with what my priorities at the time are. And some people think I don't sleep, but Remy, I find sleep really important. I wear one of those rings that measures the quality of my sleep. And if, you know, I'm very self-competitive, it's always me versus me. So if I don't get a good score, I will put that head right back on the pillow because I know it will pay off during the day in dividends.
Oh, that's amazing. If you replace Robin with Remy in that sense, in this answer, it would probably be quite an accurate description of my perspective on life. And I'm glad that we silently agree on this. Robin, throughout your days, how often do you negotiate?
Pretty much throughout the entire day, Remy. I mean, think about it. Even when you get up in the morning, like I negotiate with myself. I have a 2 to 3 hour routine. I get up quite early. I get up about 4 a.m. And, you know, if I'm a little bit late with that, my first negotiation after I say my first short prayer, which is the prayer of Jabez, I have to negotiate with what is going to fall off that beginning routine. And it kind of goes on from there. So I'm negotiating with myself. You know, I live with my husband. There's always some sort of, would you like me to make your smoothie or not? What do you want in it? And throughout the day between work and yes, I'm a ballroom dancer. There's a whole lot of silent negotiation in that. I don't know that there's much time when you don't really negotiate, although we could talk about what the word negotiate means and how different is collaboration from negotiate.
So let's start with that, since you've called it out. Let's start about your mental model or your definition. I don't want to sound too academic, but let's say, let's call it understanding. Let's call it understanding, your understanding of negotiation. And knowing that you're a ballroom dancer and a strategic businesswoman, let's try to compare it in the context of two very common analogies that are used in the literature. One, negotiation as a dance. Yes, or the other, negotiation as a game of chess. How do you?
Yes.
What is your mental model, and why is it as it is?
So before I answer it, I think it's really important to understand why I've come to the way I've come to, and it really, like many things in our life, is influenced by the way you're brought up. And sure. In my household, which was headed by an Italian mother, you know, it wasn't about you win and you lose. And sometimes I think negotiation, and certainly in real estate, you know, you think about, especially in this market, there's going to be one buyer that wins or one seller that wins. But in life, and certainly in our household, it wasn't a win-lose. It was a collaboration. I had 3 siblings. And as I said, we had a very active household running a business where we were responsible for lives, 73 lives. So it was collaboration. So in my own context and in my own history, negotiation, that word for me, is reserved when I'm more in a competitive situation that will have a winner and a loser. And collaboration is really what I feel like I do most of the time. In fact, if you go to real estate, because it's so clear in real estate, I approach the mindset always of trying to have a positive experience for everyone. And that doesn't mean that everyone's going to win, because if we're in a multiple bid situation, which in America right now, and a luxury market like a Greenwich, Connecticut, there's a lot of multiple bids. Not everyone is going to be the winner, but the entire experience of negotiation can be as collaborative as possible.
Mm-hmm. So let's have a closer look at real estate. I know you guys knew, but we are speaking with someone who is a top real estate agent, top real estate broker. I read you're in top, 1.5%
in the country? 1.5% in the country, yes.
On the Wall Street Journal list of the best real estate brokers. Congratulations, Robin. That's an amazing achievement. Yeah. And when you look back, or when you look at your negotiations in that area of real estate negotiation, which is to a large extent a win-lose, not always, but to a large extent is a win-lose type of a negotiation setting. What do you think has made you so successful as a real estate agent in those settings?
I have to go to your recent article in the Harvard Business Review, because when I read it in preparation for the call, I was giving you a huge thumbs up, because a lot of what you're talking terms of the traits of a good negotiator is what I believe and what I try to practice. So, you know, I think what's made me a good negotiator begins with an understanding of the other person and being a listener. And one of the things, Remy, that I have realized, and we could talk about this more, has really changed in the 22 years that I've been in it, is that the quality of people's listening is not like it used to be. And maybe it's because of social media and distractions and such, but I think what's made me a good negotiator is, number one, I really come into it wanting to understand the other viewpoint and not wanting to just interject and jam down my point of view. So that's really important to me. And if you think about it in real estate, there's so many different layers. So I do have a good understanding of the agent on the other side of the table, because I've worked with most of them for 20 years or more, but I don't have a good understanding of who their client is at all. That client's new to me. And my client may be a client that's a repetitive client, but many times it's a referral client. So, you know, understanding their perspective from everything from how they prioritize what's important in a home, but then within a deal, and how they like to negotiate, what their style of negotiating is, means I have to really listen, not just with my ears, but what I see before me, the body language that I'm reading, which, by the way, a lot of this is what happens in spiritual direction. As a spiritual director, I'm accompanying someone and I'm listening very intently to help them discover, you know, their path. And I'm doing the same thing here. I'm listening very intently with all of my senses so that I get maximum information that I can guide them properly to, you know, what their goal is, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that that's one of the things that's made me successful. But the other thing, and I say this because I run a small team, and they always say this back to me, that I stay very calm, but emotionally I am not involved. And I say to them all the time, let it run off your back like water runs off a duck's back. It's really important that you stay calm, not just because it will help the setting and it will help the feeling and it will help the emotionalism, but you'll be able to listen better and respond better if you're not yourself getting ramped up, and you'll help everybody else come down. I think it's really important that the agents in a transaction, you know, help set the tone. We are the experts. We are the professionals. And it's highly emotional for many people when they're buying or selling a house. So I think the second piece that really helps me is I'm very good at staying calm in very complex situations and very emotionally charged situations. The other thing is I come from a Christian perspective, whatever, a faith base. And so I'm really trying to do good. I mean, my goal is not my paycheck. My goal is to help someone be successful with what they are looking for and to exceed their happiness expectation. So that's the way I come into it. I come into it trying to make a stressful situation a positive experience for everybody. That is really most important to me, because relationships are most important to me.
That sounds amazing, and indeed, it's very much in line with with what we just recently published published on negotiation performance. What's your trick, Robin, when it comes to turning your interactions with clients into a synchronized ballroom dance rather than a strategic game of chess? As you write about rhythm, flow, how do you, you know, because at the beginning we don't know whether they know our steps, and we certainly don't know theirs, but the question is how to bridge the gap. Yes, we see someone for the first time, and we want to turn it into a dance, as I understood your initial answer.
Well, you know, Remy, it's really interesting because I have just relocated to Florida, so I have just changed dance partners, and my new dance partner is incredible. He's Russian and very, very top in the world, and has a clear foundation that even before we began dancing, he was going through the elements of the foundation. I mean, some of what I knew, but his languaging was different, and the way he prioritized them were different for me. So getting the structure or the scaffolding in place before we began dancing was critical. And this is exactly how I approach my relationships in real estate. The first few times that, let's say it's a buyer, I'm out with a buyer, I'm not in my head busy thinking about how I'm going to structure an offer. I'm busy gathering information and pointing things out to them, helping them get familiar with the town and the different locations. I have a very long history in construction and renovating homes. So when I'm looking at homes, I'm very knowledgeable about what I'm looking at from architecture, construction, and I'm starting to educate them, much like I'm being educated in dance right now, even though I have this big history in dance. You know, I'm fresh and open to learning this new scaffolding and structure. And that's how I actually approach my buyers or my sellers. First, getting the language down and first getting the scaffolding in place. And then I look at how they are reacting and how they're taking in information and what they feedback. So before we begin our dance, we have to have a way of communicating, and we have to build trust. If we don't have trust, we're not going anywhere. And I know you talked about trust in your article, but you know, it's interesting. People like to say, yes, I trust my realtor or I trust my dance partner. And it's not until you're tested that you really understand how deep the trust is. So in real estate, I think the trust is tested when you're in a multiple bid situation,
right?
When, you know, a buyer might like something that you see some concerns with, that you need to share those concerns. And in dance, the trust is really tested when you get on the competitive floor or when you're being asked to do something that might be counter to what you were told in the past, right? And sometimes for me anyway, in dance, I always use my brain and think, does this make sense? Why are they saying this? You know, does it make sense with all my cross training, all my knowledge? And if not, I will speak up and ask questions. And in my real estate world, I really encourage my clients to ask questions. And I want to make them very educated. I want them to know as much as I know around whatever it is that's relevant to their transaction. And I think that builds trust because it's true. Knowledge gives you comfort. And knowledge is a piece of gaining trust.
Indeed. Yes. So it seems that we have an echo. We're good again. So you're saying listening. Yes, that's number one. Listening to what someone is willing to reveal. Listening to what's important to them. Listening to understand their interests. And then come across as a credible source of information, someone who has the experience to deal with the complexity of the situation that they are encountering. Are those the secrets of trust building in real estate?
Yes, Yes, I think it's interesting because people have come to us because we are credible because of our track record. But, yes, you know, you always have to prove yourself, right? Sure. Just having a track record is one thing, but it's what are you doing for me today in my situation?
Yes, exactly. So, then that would be the third element: performing in a competitive situation. Yes, you mentioned that as well, both in the context of ballroom dancing as well as in negotiation.
You know, I'll tell you something that I find that's really interesting in recently, because there's so much information available to, you know, lay people now in real estate. They can feel that they're more expert than years ago when, at least in America, there was a printed book that had the first, you know, the cover picture of every house and you had to go get a key and let people in. Now they've got all these tools online that they can get information. And so they feel very expert. So when you go in and they're preparing a bid, let's say, and they're valuing for themselves, what should I offer? What is this worth? They're basing it a lot on what they've seen on screen and what you've told them. But I've been very interested to see the shift recently where a lot of this knowledge gained online is almost taking precedence over what agents are telling them. And it's, you know, I think it's a dangerous thing. And I think it's a little bit of a message I would want to say that be very careful, because what you're reading on screen online through the Zillows and through the third parties is not giving you the full information. It's giving you an algorithm that's based on information that they can get in the public domain. So, I mean, and we always explain this, my team and I, to clients. But it's a little bit more of a challenge than in the old days where, you know, there wasn't any information available. And don't get me wrong, I love that my clients are out seeking information and getting information and challenging my thoughts on a number. But, you know, it could, you've got to be careful that you're not over investing in what you're learning versus, you know, what you're also hearing.
That makes a lot of sense. Information is a source of negotiation power, right? I mean, and it's important to validate it from various our sources with different sources, right? So algorithms with expert knowledge and expert knowledge with algorithms. Robin, let's focus on the buyers and sellers because many of our viewers and listeners will be interested to find out, hey, what do I need to do if I'm selling? How can I sell for the highest possible price apart from the fact that they should contact you as their agent or sign up you as their agent and then we'll go to the buyers how they could buy at the lowest possible price knowing that it's a competitive usually typically win lose maybe you will change my opinion but at least that's how I view it from the distance without deep expertise like you have let's start with sellers or buyers, what do you prefer?
Let's start with sellers and let's talk about the industry, because I come out of consumer products where, you know, there was a lot of information online and there was a lot of statistical information online. It's very interesting. When you're pricing a house for a seller, there are no statistical models that can tell you what the perfect price would be for your house. You have history, but no two properties are alike. The land is, there's some commonalities, location, but, you know, when you look at the number of variables from the land and the quality of the land and the location of the land to the structure itself, the architectural design, the quality, the size, the condition, on and on and on, the floor plan, there's so many variables that to find like-minded to do a comparable, to come up with a very confident price opinion. If you're in a New York City and you're in a certain line of a condo building, much easier than if you're in a Greenwich, Connecticut, where, you know, there's different areas and there's a lot of variety in the homes. So the first thing is, even before you get to, you know, your final pricing, is prepping a home for the market. And what I would always say, if sellers want to get the highest price possible, they have to make the home and the land look as attractive as possible to the widest population. And that means changing your mindset from being a homeowner to being a steward of the property, where your goal is to get the highest price. And, you know, again, my team and I are relentless about the preparation work. I have some background in design interiors. And so I will not hesitate to say, we really need to empty the house. We need to bring in a stager. We need to paint, because we're just trying to appeal to today's buyer who wants white and gray and neutrals and clean lines. What am I really selling? I'm selling space. So I have to make sure the space is visible, not distracting, because I do believe, Barbara Corcoran, that buyers come in the first 8 seconds, they make up their mind, they're getting a vibe, they're getting a feeling. So I need to make sure I'm doing everything possible to set that up as strong as possible. So that's one thing for sellers. Do the upfront work to make your property look as attractive as possible. And then when we do get into the pricing and we do get into the marketing, I approach it like I approach consumer products. Who is my target market? What do they read? Where do they get their information? How do they like to see things? What are the features of this home that would appeal to them? I'll never forget, one of my clients is a very well-known producer, actor, director, and they had a very special property, which as we were prepping the home for the market, there was this third floor that was kind of empty. So I said, okay, this is now maybe 15 years ago. All right, let's set it up as a wellness room. The yoga things, the what, you know, the water bottle, everything. Do you know, a nanny saw the property, showed it to her owner who loved the yoga studio. They were the second buyers. It was $25 million. It wasn't a cheap property, and they bought it. So understanding who the target audience is and prepping a home and appealing to them, where this property was very nature-based. It had a lot of fun things. It had a lot of different animals. You know, I just leaned into that and it attracted a buyer who was very holistic oriented. So again, getting an agent who knows how to market and target and prep you for your target market's important. And then when we get to the pricing, it is digging into the analysis as best you can. And when you've got an agent that's been around a long time, they're going to be able to draw a lot of inside information. But the number one, I would say, deadly thing that sellers, I would not recommend doing, is aspirational pricing. Now, right now we have a seller's market. So, you know, can you go up and can you be a little strong arming in your price? Of course. In our market, we have a tenth of the usual inventory. So basic economics, you can push the pricing, but it's much better if you let the market push your pricing.
Ah, so you're saying a realistic price and then hope for the hope that the bids will bump it up. Yeah.
Remy, I spent a lot of years sitting in auction rooms for furniture. And this is very much like an auction mentality. Once you get two people who want the same thing, you get going on the paddle and, you know, emotion can also kick in and it's happening very fast, that this is an ideal situation for a seller.
Right.
This is what you really want, because a buyer, especially if you're calling for, okay, one more round, highest and best, it's really tough for a buyer to figure out what's the number that's going to win it. And I often say to my buyers, give me the number where if it sells for one, you know, for one tick more, you're not going to be unhappy because you just didn't believe in that next tick. And, you know, recently I had a buyer say, that's so unfair because I'm always going to go up one more tick. So I hope I just lost my earbud. So tell me if you can't hear me,
we can hear you.
To the best possible, it's important to ask that question.
Mm-hmm. So, Robin, it's amazing to see how you've changed when we started talking real estate. To see your enthusiasm, your passion, the whole energy that's radiating out of you.
Yeah.
And we only halfway through, we only spoke about the sellers, right? Let's then move over to the other side. Let's move over to buyers.
Yeah. So buyers, look, it's a really tough time to be a buyer. I mean, when we're looking at how little inventory, we do a lot off market on my team. So we're partly scrappy, but we are finding ourselves in a lot of multiple bid situations. Yeah. So what I would say to buyers is, number one, and one of the greatest all-time realtors in my market who has since passed used to say, Robin, don't just give them what they ask for. Give them what they want, but they don't even know they want. And I have never forgotten that information. I think it really holds true for lots of negotiation. And that goes back to getting to know the people so well and getting to learn their lifestyle and getting to hear what their family is about and what's important to them. What are their values? Because what is a home is, you know, how am I using the home? Am I someone who has people over all the time? Do I need a lot of spaces that are quiet spaces? Does somebody in my home have a big hobby that it would be great if they could lean into that hobby here at home than running outside? Is nature important? So there's a lot of things they're not going to think to tell me that I need to go into a big process of discovery, so that I can think creatively about properties that they may not even be thinking about. This is really important. Now, the thing about buyers is also gaining their trust is critical, because many of them come in, you know, New York City is a big driver for us, and we're working with some of them now, and they come from such a different world where they're living in much smaller quarters and they're not able to access things like parks and things as easily as you could do when you get to a suburb. So educating them and getting them, a lot of times I'll say, go out to lunch down the avenue, go sit in the library, go get to know the town, get to know the different areas, because how are you going to, if you just pick a house, but you know, we've got 43 square miles, you might have picked the wrong area. So go and do the work and get to know, what are you really liking about our town versus just the reputation of our town? And then let's keep refining as we look at things. And that's also why I will show you a lot of homes and I will say, I'm not sure about that to a lot of homes, not just because of the quality of a home maybe, but it could be the location. And so look, it's ultimately the buyer's decision, but I want them to be really well educated. I am not driving them to a property down the best side streets so they get the best view. You know, our first home in our town was sold to us without telling us that there was a parkway on the other side of the trees. I'm never going to do that to someone. I'm going to show you all the different ways to get to your property and where it's located so that you can make a really informed decision. That's what I want buyers to do, make a really informed decision. And then when it gets around the pricing, to stay calm, but know, you know, if it's a good property, it's going to be a fist fight. There's just no way around it in 2025. So buckle up. And if you're going to play, you know, recognize that, will you overpay? Yeah, in many cases, and ourselves, we just recently bought a property somewhere else and we definitely paid, you know, higher than the market price, but we just figured in our research, it's going to be fine long term. So
That sounds amazing. So it seems that the way market structure or market procedures, let me call it that way, in the U.S. real estate market, they seem to be somewhat different than in other places in the world, because you guys seem to have replaced at least part of the negotiation with the bidding process. And I was going to ask you about exactly that share. And you know, what is the share of transactions that you actually accompany that are based purely on bids versus those where there's an extensive or intensive and extensive at the same time negotiation phase between a buyer and the seller, or multiple buyers and the seller.
Oh, let me not mislead you. Even in a multiple bid situation, you know, you win the bid. Now, this is not true in every market. Some markets, you win a bid, you give a certain amount of money to put a binder on the property. And that means nobody can interrupt it. In Greenwich, Connecticut, we're a little bit of the wild, wild west. Anyone can interrupt that bid until a contract is signed. That just happened to me on a huge property last week where we were the winning bid, and literally the day my buyer was going to fund the contract, somebody came in and interrupted our bid. So, you know, there was a couple weeks. So once you win a bid, you still have to get through a building inspection.
Sure.
You still have to get through anything that came out of the inspection, the pool inspection, the radon, sure, the termite, you know, septic well, anything that could be involved. Then you might be going back to the seller asking for a credit. There might be all of a sudden the seller, I've had this happen more than one time. Seller wants to stay in the house longer. Seller wants, you know, maybe that won't work for my buyer. Seller wants to remove, I've had a seller who's removed a number of light fixtures. It wasn't really clear in the beginning. So things can happen and the negotiation, yes, can take sometimes 2-3 weeks, which, you know, is nerve-wracking for a buyer, emotionally charged for everyone. So now you've got two lawyers involved, a buyer and seller, and not just one, usually multiple people, the agents representing them. You've got a lot of different personalities, right, that you're working through, and you're trying to resolve issues where people are seeing things differently. And a lot of times what they're seeing differently is around money. So that's really, you know, very emotional.
Yes, absolutely. So let's talk about a situation which I've always wondered, and probably many potential buyers and sellers as well. How often, in your experience, does it happen that a property is sold not to the highest bidder, but someone who actually offered a lower price, but for other reasons was able to get the object, get the property at the end? Does it happen at all?
Especially at the high end of the market, Remy. And it's a great question, because in this market that's so competitive, the first thing I say if I'm representing a buyer to the selling agent is, what's important to your seller? I want to know, and again, it's gaining information, what is it going to be besides the number that's going to put us at the front of the line? So, you know, in this recent case, my buyer was very flexible on when he would close. I mean, he was willing to close, you know, a number of months later, and that was really appealing initially to the seller. So I like to look at timing to close, all cash offer. I mean, I don't like to do this. I rarely recommend this, but some people will say we're not doing any inspections. I mean, that to me puts so much risk on my buyers. I don't like it. If it's a new property, new product, you know, new home, and I really know the builder and there's a one-year warranty, sure, and it's highly competitive, you know, from my little perspective, I'm going to give the blessing to my buyer to say, fine, let's take it off. It certainly is appealing to sellers. So there are things I think that you can do, and knowing what's important to the seller is great, because then you can respond and craft your offer.
Yes. So it happens. Based on preferences, which are sort of non-monetary, yeah, such as structure, yeah, of the transaction and timing or various timing, yes, aspects. Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, which means this sort of emphasizes and underscores the role of listening. Yes. So if you guys, yes, want to buy cheaper, make sure that, yeah, you listen to the preferences of your sellers. Yes. Because there might be reasons for them to accept your bid, even if it's lower than the highest bid, just because you fit better.
And I'm going to respond to one thing you just said. In this particular market, which may be different from where you are, where it's so highly competitive, it's not that, I don't want to put it in people's head that you're going to perhaps get something cheaper, as much as you're going to put yourself in a more favorable situation.
Right.
There's not really deals happening today from a we're buying under market, unless there's something that's a little bit of a red flag on the property right now, and the buyer's okay with the red flag.
Yes, absolutely. Buying under market is probably unrealistic anyway, anywhere in the world. But the question becomes, you know, how much above market, right? So is it a lot above market or just a little bit above market? Yes. Yeah. All right. Robin, what are the biggest mistakes when you look back at the real estate negotiations? Doesn't matter whether from the buyers or on the buyer's side or on the seller's side or real estate agent side, right? What are the biggest mistakes that you've observed, or maybe you've made them yourselves in the past, that you see in these negotiations and transactions?
Yeah, I would say from the seller's perspective, the biggest mistakes I've seen are sellers substantially changing a deal after they've accepted an offer, because then the buyer just loses trust, sure. You know, and the goodwill, as I always say, is lost. So I would say that's a mistake. Sometimes the number one thing for me is I always say we need to keep a pace and a rhythm on the deal. And, you know, maybe this is my instinctual dancing. I don't know. But I really have found, and if I were to do a piece of research, I bet it would hold true that if you lose the rhythm of a deal, if you lose the rhythm of a negotiation, there's exhaustion that kicks in. There's lack of focus that kicks in. All the good energy of that pacing dissipates. So I always am a real stickler for, we have to keep a good pace on this deal. We have to keep the rhythm. We need to keep their focus. We need them to stay engaged with us, locked into the dance with us, you know, feeling good about us, or things could just go sideways.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, is it all about, how do you translate the rhythm, the flow, the pace into let's say concrete steps in a transaction or a negotiation process? Does it mean fast, or does it mean appropriately slow, or
Here's the thing. Every seller and buyer has a different internal clock of how they negotiate. Some like a lot of baby steps. Some like to really think so long about something. What I would say, if you want a rule of thumb, do not let 24 hours pass by without responding to the other side. It's basic etiquette. I think there is some negotiation etiquette that needs to be observed. And in my book, it's kind of like any relationship. Don't let 24 hours go by if someone's reached out to you. I don't care how busy you are. Just acknowledge that you've received it and give them a sense of when you're responding so that their expectations are managed and they still feel like you're in relationship with them.
Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So it's which means it's individual. It has to fit our negotiations partner's internal pace clock or rhythm.
Yeah.
And at the same time, there are some norms, let me say it like this, some norms which sort of are, I'd say, universal in the Western world. That's the sort of the 24-hour response which we feel on things that we consider important to us. We usually try to squeeze our reaction into that time frame.
You know, it's interesting. I think one of the lowest hanging fruits is being a good communicator. I'm exploring a different project right now. And I put a number of questions onto the other side as we negotiate. And I've not gotten a response in, you know, 3 days. And to me, that A is putting out a little alarm bell for myself. How is this going to be as a partner? And number two, it goes back to this etiquette, and just being a good communicator means being responsive and just letting them know you're still there in the room.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I think that's really being a good communicator. Which, what does that mean? It means being responsive. It also means being very clear. Like I've written a couple of books. I love to write, and I'm a very organized writer. So I kind of always write in an outline in my head. So you're very clear with, you know, topic, point, topic. I last year I took up improvisational acting, which I absolutely love. And one of the things I've learned from there is don't talk so much. Really, really synthesize your information and try to get it across as fast as possible to move the scene along. And you can say that in life too. Like, you know, you don't need to take a whole 5 sentences if you can say it in 1 sentence.
Mm-hmm. Yes, communication, negotiation is a communication. Every negotiation is a communication process. It's unavoidable, and the better we can communicate, the more successful we usually are as negotiators. Robin, I was thinking, you know, you are an extremely accomplished person, right? Top 1.5% in the country. I mean, that's crazy, first of all. And second, I was thinking, you know, when you look back at your career and think about your biggest success, your biggest negotiation success. I'm not sure whether it is measured in the size of the deal or in other parameters, in other dimensions. But what comes to your mind when you think about your success in a field where you're already extremely successful? And please be mindful that we don't have an entire day to mention everything.
Yeah. So recently, someone in my world, I happened to read something that he was talking about when he was asked this question. And I loved his answer. He said, you know, when I'm calm in my brain. And I'll tell you, I love that answer because success is for me when I'm not worrying about, you know, one of my clients. So success is just having a peace that everyone's taken care of and everyone's happy. But my successes in real estate, okay, one of my largest financial deals was one of my successes only because I absolutely love this family. They're everyone from, and it's a very well-known family in America, but their family office, the people that take care of them. I've been lucky enough to work for the children. They are so good at being clear partners. We are so partnered. We're such a great team. We respect each other. Everything's transparent. We have fun. I mean, that is a great success because I've partnered with them, I don't know, 4 or 5 times. And it's always fantastic. So that's one. But equally successful was, you know, I remember this older couple asked me to just come look at their condo as they started to think about down the line going to somewhere different. And because my parents run a nursing home and I have a nursing home administrator's license, I know what to look for. You had to go up a flight of stairs to get to their first floor. I took one look at the husband and realized this is not a good situation for him. I mean, I could read a lot of signs. And so I, you know, encouraged them to immediately shift where they were going. And it was, the timing could not have been so perfect because he got a diagnosis that would not have made him able to climb stairs much longer. So that to me is a success. Being aware, reading the room, taking action. You know, I remember another one where an older person was very sick and was a hoarder. And we had to go in as a SWAT team and get that house ready to. So where we can make a substantial difference, where I've made a substantial difference and where I've really partnered with my clients and I felt like we really worked together and we respected each other and we were transparent and we listened and there was a lot of trust and fun. That's a success for me. And it's not just real estate. It's everything I
everywhere,
do, you know?
Everywhere. That sounds like a huge exclamation mark. We're almost coming to an end, but almost at the end of our discussion. I was thinking also, since you've made so much experience with elderly people, and you're a nurse, you grew up not in a nursing home, but in a family that operated one. But when you sort of look at how perspective changes with age, yes, on negotiation, on success. Do you see any patterns? And if yes, what are your observations when it comes to, you know, how people negotiate, what becomes important to them, more important, maybe less important, and how do they perceive success in negotiation and beyond and beyond?
So I think you're maybe asking me, as we go through life, do I see differences in how we negotiate and within myself as well? And I would say, yes, definitely. The biggest change I see in others and myself is that you have the perspective that today is not the end all and be all, that it's going to be okay. There's going to be a resolution somehow, some way. So let's all take a deep breath and make the experience, you know, not, I mean, I was never a yeller, but I've had plenty of clients who are yellers. Let's not make it emotionally charged. Let's try to get through this so that afterwards we can find something positive that we learned from and something positive about the other people. I think that's the biggest thing that I see. And I see that, you know, some people as they're older that are my clients have so much wisdom around them because they've taken the lessons and now they take the time to apply them. And they know it's, we're going to figure this out one way or another. And if it's not meant to be, there'll be something else. And I see that for myself as well. I mean, I've lost some big deals recently. I've had some big deals. It really doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is how the relationship went, how the experience went, and what I've learned from it. I mean, I always say to the team, and they always say back to me, what did we learn from this? And that's what's critical, because when you actually observe what you've learned, you can do it better, however you're defining better, next time. Same thing in every competition in ballroom. Same thing every time I meet with one of my directees in spiritual direction. You know, what can I do better next time? What was, what did, what felt really good? Where was I in the flow and where was I not in the flow?
That's amazing. I love your perspective, and maybe we should schedule another one on exactly on this topic, because I can imagine that it's not only relevant to all of us, yes, but it's a topic which, or aging, negotiation and success, or changing perspectives on negotiation, yes, and success, is something that I feel that we don't dare to talk about enough, sufficiently enough. Yeah,
and for, you know, some reason, it's interesting, because think about it. A lot of people, before they become older, had a lot of power in their positions, whether it was work or within the family. And as you age, obviously, you're losing the natural power positions that defined you. So now how you negotiate and how you find your purpose, which is, you know, a little bit what we talked about before the show, my Aging with Purpose platform, is critical to really keep yourself defined and fulfilled and growing. So yeah, I'd welcome a conversation on that. I've been doing a lot of thinking and talking about it.
I know. Guys, and if you're interested, there are a couple of videos which are very insightful and fun to watch that Robin has recorded with various guests. And you will find them, some of them on her website, but some of them, I think, on YouTube as well.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. My last question is always the same. And that's about greatness, greatness in negotiation, greatness in life. So I usually ask, always ask my guests about people who inspire them, or people that come to their mind when they think about greatness in negotiation. Is there someone, Robin, that comes to your mind when you think about great negotiators or people who have inspired the way you are negotiating right now?
Yeah, I have to say two people. One is Mother Cabrini, which you might know was this little nun that came, you know, got permission from the Pope to come to New York, and she was going to work with the immigrants. And she got here. No one met her when she got off the boat, and she went to the Archbishop and he said, oh, I've changed my mind. I don't need you in New York. Go back to Italy. And she said, no, I'm going to help the immigrants. And she did. And if anyone has read about her or seen the movie, she made an enormous difference among, you know, orphanages and the sick in Manhattan. And what I love about her is she had to negotiate in the face of no. She had zero power in the ways that we measure power. She had no money. She was a woman. She didn't speak the language. She was doing something highly unpopular that they didn't want even want to admit existed in fancy Manhattan. So that's one. And the other one is Condoleezza Rice, because she really broke through the glass ceiling. And, you know, if you look at her life and you listen to her, she is really inspiring in the way she negotiates. She negotiates from an information base and from a collaborative base. And yeah, I put those two on my list.
Thank you so much, Robin. And let me join Pranash, who has been commenting our chat in the background. I've enjoyed our conversation a lot. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with our listeners and viewers. It's been an immense pleasure and honor to have you on the show, Robin. I hope you enjoyed it as well. Good luck in all your future deals. Yes, and
thank you.
If they don't materialize monetarily, I'm sure you will learn something from each of them. Thank you so much.
You're right about that. Thank you. It was a great conversation. I enjoyed it.
Thank you, Robin. Take care.
Bye-bye.